I'd like to introduce our next speaker. Dr. Jason Smith is an associate professor of surgery at the University of Louisville. He's going to be speaking this morning on hypertonic saline, volume status, and my favorite, DPR.
Well, good morning, everybody. I will say I have no financial disclosures. I am going to be talking about some data here at the end of this presentation that was supported by the NIH and the DOD, and I will give the appropriate DOD response that this is not the government's ideas, these are my ideas. And don't hold them accountable, or me for them. One of the first things I always tell you is I've got hypertonic saline, volume control status, and DPR, and this is my first to all of you as a cake is a lie. I'm going to start talking about a lot of different things, but I think what you're going to find is we start looking through hypertonic saline, there's thousands of papers talking about that. There's, if not more, of those papers talking about assessing volume status. And what I'm going to give you is kind of my gestalt and opinion of all of those cases moving forward. And why is that? So this is a in vivo microscopy that we do in the lab, and I'll show this. A little bit. This is what normal capillary blood flow looks like. Laminar flow moves well, has no difficulties as far as moving through the system itself. When we take an animal and we shock that animal with after hemorrhage, even if we make their central hemodynamic parameters normal, this is what their capillary blood flow looks like to their visceral organs. Now, on the outside, this animal looks normal. We've looked at all their physiologic parameters, we've corrected their blood loss, we've given them their shed blood back, and yet we still don't have great blood flow to those organs. And we've known that for a long time. Even if we can deliver that blood centrally, we have a difficult time getting that blood to the organs. So we're surgeons, and I'm going to try and make this as simple as possible. There are literally thousands of factors that go into figuring this out, but one of the simple things is if we have decreased oxygen delivery, we have an increased anaerobic metabolism within the cells, be that endothelial cells or organ cells themselves. That increases the hydrogen ion production, and the body can handle that as long as there's energy. It'll move the hydrogen around, it'll move the sodium through the pumps, it'll use the sodium-potassium pump to move it out of the cell, and everything is fine. It can buffer itself, cellular processes go along. The problem becomes is that as we progress forward in shock, we now don't have that ATP because we're not making that energy at the same rate. So that when we pump this sodium into the cells, it has nowhere to go. Water always follows sodium. We know that for a long time. And what happens is the endothelial cells begin to swell, and that disrupts the cytoskeleton of those cells, that disrupts the physiologic processes within them, so that even if we're able to reestablish that blood flow, we've messed up the endothelial cells, we've decreased the luminal capacity of those capillaries, and we can't get the end organs perfused well. And we see this. Again, this is one of our laboratory models, and you can see here that we're able to shock these animals and resuscitate them back to normal parameters. And yet, if we look at their end organ blood flow, you can see that despite the fact that those animals have normal central hemodynamic parameters, they've got a progressive decline in hepatic and end organ blood flow following this. So there's our problem, is you can't make the numbers better because it doesn't really fix that problem. And the end result of this is organ death. Again, this is a hemorrhagic shock model. This is rat ileum. And you can see normal DAPI, and actually this is staining for the mucosa. But by 24 hours after shock with conventional resuscitations of crystalloid, you can see that you've had almost complete disruption of the cytoskeletal membranes and disruption of the luminal capacity of the GI tract, such that the mucus is now invaginating into the cellular walls of the organ itself. And you get that invagination of damage-associated markers and damage-associated proteins that will lead to inflammation and end-organ death. And so we want to limit our resuscitation, and as our other authors have talked about, over-resuscitation is just as bad. We've lived through this as well. You can see this by the time you can't get these abdomens closed. So we've got to think about some different ways that we can address this. Well, the first way is how do we assess the actual volume status of these surgical patients? And what I'll tell you is there is no single measure anywhere that you're going to be able to hang your hat on and say, this is how I'm going to assess the volume status of these patients. When you look at it, I think this is one of the things where you have to take in the gestalt of everything occurring to the patient. What do their central hemodynamics look like? What do their lactate and base deficits look like? What are their coagulation studies? How did this patient improving from a physiologic standpoint to the point that I can get them back to the operating room? And again, this is the old paradigm that kind of what you look at is what you see. And I always say more information is sometimes better and not always. Two of the things I am going to touch base on real quick, because this is what always gets asked of me, is the arterial pulse wave analysis and then using ultrasound. We've seen arterial pulse wave analysis for a long period of time. This is Vigileo, FlowTrack, Pico, Lidco. It's been around for about 20 or 30 years commercially. It's been around longer than that. And the problem becomes, particularly with damage control surgery, is that the arterial pulse wave works really well in very controlled circumstances where we don't have a lot of intra-abdominal variability or intra-abdominal pressure changes, particularly if we don't have arrhythmias or things like that that can mess up the measurement of the arterial pulse wave analysis. But unfortunately, all the patients that we're talking about throw in about 10 different variables that can't be controlled for, and so the numbers produced by many of these things, again, don't really correlate with what's going on with these patients. What we always remind our residents is we're looking for the trends. Tell me where you start, tell me where you end, tell me what you're doing to evaluate these patients. And so it's a great tool. I don't mind using a Vigileo, but I will say that it is not an end-all, be-all. And I give them the same warnings that I give when we used to use PA catheters all the time, as don't make it a random number generator. If it's in, use it. If it's not in and you're not using it, get rid of it. Ultrasound has actually come to one of the forefronts, at least in our own institution, of trying to get an idea of what their individual volume status looks like. But again, I will give my own personal story, is I'm the outlier for all of these ultrasound trials. If you're looking for the one person that required like 2 liters of the DPL solution into the animal to identify a positive fast scan, that was me. I messed all those studies up. I'm not the best ultrasonographer, and so the problem becomes is that my readings are not always as good as many of the readings of my partners that can do these kind of things. And so when we see the changes in the IVC, and we see the changes associated with increased preload within the heart, it is so operator dependent that you have to be very confident in your skill set in order to assess whether or not you're getting an adequate picture of volume resuscitation in that patient. As always, it is simply a measure to looking at the overall response to the patient to the resuscitation strategy that you've put forward. When you look at that, there's two significant studies. There's an East PMG that came out in 2018 that assessed both these technologies. There's also an international evidence-based recommendation around ultrasound and looking at it as evaluating a resuscitation strategy in 2014. Both of them, interestingly, said it's useful. We just don't know how useful, but maybe you should try it more often. I will leave that to all of the audience to interpret. So the take-home message is they're ready when they're ready, but when they're ready, get them back to the operating room. This is as one of my other mentors once said, that's why it's called an art of surgery, son, not the cookbook of surgery. And that there's no simple answers to many of these volume resuscitation questions. We have to individually look at these, and we have to individually identify the patients and when they are ready to go back to the operating room. It's elbow grease, it's late nights, and it's washing that patient at bedside. And it doesn't matter if the patient is volume resuscitated at 2 o'clock or in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. When we identify that that patient is physiologically competent to go back to the operating room, we need to get them back to the operating room and get the abdomen closed as soon as possible, because we understand from the papers that have been presented already this morning that there's an increased incidence of complications and death on those patients that have their abdomens left open. Now, what are the options for managing these patients? I'm going to talk about hypertonic saline, but really you can go through the gamut of crystalloid, isotonic, hypertonic, colloids, albumin, head of starch, and the blood products. And this is one of those questions where there's really only bad options. What we would love to have is the patient's whole blood or not have lost that blood in the first place. And what we need to identify is for these patients, what's the best option that we can put forward to fix the physiologic derangement to get them back to the operating room? I'll touch base quickly on hypertonic saline. I won't be able to go through the thousands of papers that are out there regarding hypertonic saline. But again, let's go back to the diagram and understand the simple fact of how this works. We have the same problem. We've got physiologic shock, and we're still moving the hydrogen and sodium around. The difference becomes with hypertonic saline is we're keeping a significant saline load in the interstitial space that holds that water outside of the cell, so that we don't get the cellular swelling associated with the movement of the electrons across the membranes of the cell. If we don't have that cellular swelling, then we're able to eventually deliver that blood back in a more efficient manner. Now, it obviously has lots of other things that are going on in and around the cell, can talk about the glycocalyx of the cell and how well it does or does not break down in response to hypertonic saline. But the simple fact of the matter is we're decreasing cellular edema and we're increasing oxygen delivery to the peripheral tissues. We're also doing it with a lower volume of crystalloid resuscitation. Now, my colleagues up here on the podium produced one of the best papers looking at this. When Dr. Harvin and Cotton and their colleagues were looking at using hypertonic saline to resuscitate these patients following damage control surgery, they were able to do this and identify really that they can give half the amount of volume to these patients and maintain absolutely appropriate hemodynamic parameters in the patients that are left open. And I think that's one of the keys to this, because as you move forward in that manuscript, one of the things you see is that they were able to close them primarily more efficiently following damage control surgery, and not only that, they were able to close them sooner. So they're able to get back into continuity and get them actually closed and resuscitated in a more standard fashion as opposed to damage control. And I think that's one of the keys you can't really overlook in this paper, is that a decreased volume load led to an increase in the amount of time that closure rates of these patients. Now, this is where I get into the sidetrack warning. We came up with a different idea. I think the hypertonic saline idea is a fantastic, because I understand that. And I always say it's the simple ideas that you can understand from the simple physiology that kind of work. Our idea was different in that, and again, thinking back to how this started, we were giving patients 11 liters of crystalloid in a 24-hour period as part of a resuscitation strategy. And we understood that that was causing a lot of edema in our patients, and we understood that that was causing difficulties in the resuscitation of those patients after we were getting them through the first 24 to 48 hours. And we were paying up front, and it was costing us in the end of the resuscitation. So we came up with the idea of peritoneal resuscitation. And what this is we actually apply a hypertonic, a glucose-based peritoneal dialysis solution to the abdomen while we're resuscitating the patients in damage control surgery. We basically leave catheters in and we lavage this with the commercially available peritoneal dialysis fluid. And again, think about it from a physiologic standpoint, we're using a different molecule to provide the same type of physiologic mechanism. Now all of a sudden we're using glucose. Sugar-based, it actually does a lot of other things, but for the most part, when we're looking at the resuscitation strategy, now we don't have, again, the cellular disruption of the endothelial membranes, and when we're able to increase oxygen delivery, we're now able to get the blood flowing better to those patients. And we saw this in the laboratory model. You can see here, as we look at it, the blue will represent our DPR group, and that in the animal model, you can see that during our hemorrhage and shock, we have decreased blood flow, about 60%. Decrease from baseline, but following resuscitation, if we were able to give them peritoneal resuscitation, we were able to maintain a normal physiologic hepatic blood flow in these animals really for up to 7 hours, and if you check this at 24 hours, it's absolutely normal. Whereas in animals that were given conventional resuscitation, which was their shed blood plus two volumes of crystalloid, what you found was a progressive decline in the hepatic blood flow of these animals, regardless of what we did afterwards. And this was one of the most telling things that we saw. If you look at a 24-hour survival model of these animals, you can see significant central necrosis in the liver starting at 24 hours out related to the resuscitation they got with crystalloid. Again, physiologically, the animals looked normal from a blood pressure, heart rate standpoint. And yet, if you gave them peritoneal resuscitation, it didn't get this central necrosis. You got normal blood flow back to those organs. When you give them intraperitoneal saline, it didn't work. So you have to do something to affect the osmolarity and the osmotic challenge that are facing these cells following resuscitation. And I always say, well, that's great, but I'm not a rat doctor, so how does this apply to people? So we ran our first trial in 2006, 7, and 8. We looked at applying this to patients in a damage control setting, and in that setting, what we found is we were able to get our patients closed 98% of the time in this small group of patients with primary fascial closure. Hernia at 6 months, we had one hernia in our DPR group versus 12 in our control group, and most of those were related to a stage closure that we had to skin grafts and the like. And finally, we had much fewer abdominal complications. So from a practical standpoint, we had fixed our problem with crystalloid resuscitation, and we felt that was cool. I initially presented this at the Southern Surgical, December 2nd, I believe, 2007. And then there was this fantastic paper talking about damage control resuscitation that came out December 20th, 2007. And it really changed the practice of all of us in surgery looking at aggressive blood component therapy in these patients. And so now all of a sudden we weren't giving liters and liters of crystalloid, we were giving units and units of blood. And what we found with that is that, you know what? Units of units of blood do better. Again, we're replacing what's lost, we're keeping the osmolarity normal, we're not messing up the cytoskeleton and messing up the cells themselves. So I say, I missed it by that much. Give me a few more weeks, this would have been a fantastic idea. But I'll be honest, I think it's still a fantastic idea. I went forward with a randomized controlled trial. This was the one that was sponsored by the DOD. And we did the exact same thing. Again, we standardized resuscitation protocols for both groups. We allowed the surgeons of the groups to direct those resuscitation protocols. And all we did was randomize whether or not, if they got a damage control laparotomy, did they get peritoneal resuscitation during that time. Well, if you looked at those study dynamics, everything was the normal, but I think one of the more telling things is that we really didn't change our resuscitation strategy around those. And again, they're comparable to what I would see across different resuscitation models and different papers looking at resuscitation. They had normal or relatively normal red blood cell, FFP, and IV fluid volumes across the first 24 hours. And they were also consistent with what we were currently doing in practice with increased blood volume. They're also consistent with the fact that we're giving upwards of about 26 units of total products in the first 24 hours to these patients, so they were sick. When we actually looked at time to fascial closure, I would love to tell you it was as awesome as it was the first study. The first study, we managed to cut 6 days off of our operative time. In this study, we were able to cut about 2 days off of our closure rates and our damage control in the patients that got peritoneal resuscitation versus conventional. Our primary fascial closure rates were actually much higher. And the number of operations to closure was about one less. Again, we're getting them closed about a day less. Additionally, when we looked at this complication rate, we didn't quite make it, but we did notice we had decreased numbers of complications overall. And when we looked at the interventions that were required, draining abscesses or doing something to wound infections or what have you, there's a decreased number of those as well across the patients that received peritoneal resuscitation. And finally, if you look at our ICU length of stay and our overall hospital length of stay, those patients did better. They were closed sooner, and I think that was really the practical mark of this. Getting the patients closed sooner gets them out of the hospital, gets them out of the ICU, they do better. And finally, we didn't quite make it in our overall mortality because it was, again, a smaller study. But in a randomized controlled trial, we were able, with 50 patients, to show a decrease in the number of hospital deaths and the 30-day mortality, just not quite statistically significant. What I really think is we look at the expansion of damage control outside of trauma is the use of peritoneal dialysis will tell you that I think has got a bigger indication outside of this than it currently does for trauma. I think we've got a better way of resuscitating patients. I still think it helps, but I don't think it's going to be as earth-shattering as we initially thought. However, when you actually look at this applied to an abdominal sepsis, what you find is some very interesting things. For example, the patients that received DPR that had damage control surgery for abdominal sepsis had a better coagulation profile, had better renal function, had better hepatic function and lung function than those that did not. And I think that is an interesting point. If you think about the practical aspect of this and what I had spoken about before, I'm really talking about reducing edema in the tissue and inducing edema in the body wall so we can get things closer using peritoneal resuscitation. But we're seeing a significant physiologic change in remote organs, organs that are not directly impacted by the hypertonic solution. And so we're changing the inflammatory milieu in some way, shape, or form here to decrease the inflammation in those distant organs. When we looked at this in trauma, I will tell you that we could never really see a difference in the thoracic organs, and that was probably because we had a high predominance of thoracic injuries. As I said, we were sick patients, and so they were probably overcome by anything that we'd see for injuries. But also telling is the fact that this is a population that we don't give a lot of blood to. They don't need a lot of blood. And sooner or later, we've got to find another solution to resuscitating our patients, be that hypertonic saline or crystalloid or albumin. Again, the best of a bunch of bad choices. we have to find a way to mitigate some of those known physiologic effects down the way. And I think peritoneal resuscitation gives us that option moving forward. So when you looked at their actual closure rates and vent days, they were significantly decreased across the board. And I think if we look at this, and we're going to look at this a little more closely in the future, this is the option and this is the area where I think we can make a significant impact in resuscitating these patients. So I'll close there, and I thank everyone for their attention this morning.